My talk now. I'm wired up. So my name is Paul Irofti or Irofti or whatever you want to call it in English. I have no idea how you spell that. I'm an OpenBSD developer and I'm going to talk about my efforts on porting OpenBSD on the Octeon machines, if you can call them that. So I split this talk in a few key sprints that I did on the Octeon. The first part was getting the box and trying to get to user land, which turned out that machine memory needed to be fixed for that. Then a couple of drivers, simple drivers, and then they get more complicated on the way as I get to know the machine better, and some future projects at the end and conclusions. Mostly, I'm a reverse engineer. I work in the antivirus industry, doing emulators and research in static and dynamic analysis. I'm also an OpenBSD hacker since 2008. I've been doing mainly power management and ACPI work in the kernel, but that's gotten past the point where it's satisfying. So I started looking for other projects that are more constructive so that I can have the energy to go back to ACPI and power management whenever a new laptop comes along that doesn't work and that I don't own and don't care about, so I need to fake that I care about it and I want to fix it. So for that, I looked at Lungsan, which is another useless piece of hardware, but it was really nice working on it because I could do something constructive that I could see actual results instead of emails of yay, it's working. I also worked on Compat Linux after being asked for like a year or two by two close friends from the project. I took a look at it because it's related to the, well, related. It's an emulator, so they said, hey, you're doing emulators for AV work, so this should be the same. No, it's not the same, but it was easier for me than it was for them, I guess. And I also port stuff to OpenBSD, like applications, which is, again, frustrating but interesting. So it might seem that I'm looking for frustrating projects. So that's why I decided to, hey, let's do something else. Let's do a PhD on signal processing, which is what I graduated from faculty with, license, or how do you call it here? It's a dissertation, yes. For parallel signal processing, my PhD involves general purpose GPU computing with OpenCL and CUDA, with applications in the medical system, like for CT scans and in the, all sort of things that involve identifying images, cleaning them up, or compressing them. So that's me. How I got into this whole Octeon thing is by chance, actually. I played with other MIPS ports, which is a bit of SGI and mostly the Lungsan part. But then last year, actually, exactly a year ago, I was at T2K13, which was a hackathon in Toronto, where I was sitting next to Jasper, which is a really cool guy that brought along an edge router light or something. It was a really small box. And he was he's younger than me, but he started getting wrinkles already, and they seem permanent during coffee breaks. And I asked him, hey, what are you doing there? Seems fun. And he told me he was working on the installer for this Octeon machine. I only heard about it from commit logs and talks, but I was interested and I wanted to see what it's all about. So I started helping him a bit now and then, just like tap, oh, come on, you can do it, because that's my expertise in regards to Octeons at that point. And after a day or two, I got to know a bit about Octeons, but my work involved mostly doing Hibernate on Lungsan, so I didn't focus on it, but I did mention it in the Undeadly report afterwards, after the hackathon, And Diana was nice enough to email me and ask if I want a machine. And I said yes, and I got a machine. And this is how I got into this whole Octeon business. The machine was interesting because it wasn't supported at all by the OpenBSD port. It was a D-Link DSR 500 machine. It was the first time I heard about it, so it was as new to me as the machine I saw on Jasper's desk. So I got it, unpacked it. It has a nice console plug and cable, and I was able to just connect it and get into U-boot, which is very interesting if you're trying to look at how you're supposed to boot anything on it. It apparently varies depending on what model you're running and how it's compiled. And I finally managed to sum it up to these three commands: get a lease, TFTP boot 0 BSD from a TFTP server, and then just issue this magic command, which is the only one that works because it has Linux at the end. The one that has ELF at the end doesn't. I don't know why. I don't really care why. But this is how you get it to boot a BSD kernel. It came with a Linux operating system with a really retarded shell, OSH or something. I read about it briefly. It seemed like it's something that just gives you 5 or 6 commands to easily configure the router / switch. I just fetched the D message and saved it in my notes, and then I never went back. I just booted this. And of course, because this was never tested on the DSR, the kernel crashed right after the copyright, which is always interesting to see, the copyright. Yeah. So I said, oh, this is going to be a lot more work than I expected. And actually, it turned out not to be. I found the crash pretty fast, and it wasn't something that we didn't support, or it was just a very common mistake of how we managed the Octeon memory. Basically, the memory is split into 3 chunks. The first chunk is the first 256 megabytes of memory. The second is what's past that, and then all the way to 512, and then there's the rest of the memory if you're lucky enough to have that much memory on that MIPS machine. So my model had 128 megabytes of memory, which apparently was something that nobody saw before. And the system assumed that I must have more than that, which was not true. And so the bug was that it assumed, well, the way that the memory is constructed, it gets the real memory bytes. We reserve some of them for later, and the rest we make available for the system. And it wasn't looking if this real memory chunk is bigger than 256. It just assumed it is. And so it did this subtraction where you see the bug. It subtracted from 128 to 256 megs. So it wrapped around, of course. And so I ended up with a lot of memory, which was fake, of course. So I had to fix that to make sure that we check that it's not a memory-challenged machine that has less than 256 megabytes. So I thought, oh, okay, this fix was easy. I'll probably just see the CPU attach or anything. But no, actually, I got to use LAN. It was that easy. So in 2 weeks, I could add the DSR as a port that you can boot on. Of course, looking at the D message, it wasn't really a working port. It was just a port that was reaching user land, which is pretty easy if you do nothing. And just a few issues with it was that you'll see across the drivers that the Octeon has that most of them are prefixed with OCT from Octeon. Some of them have CN 30XX something that's coming from the IIJ port, IIJ being the company, the Japanese company that initially supplied the code for this port to OpenBSD. So the first one is the compact flash that was the huge compact flash that the DSR 500 has, which is 32 megabytes, which is not supported. Also, there's a PCI memory address conflict that I wasn't able to pin down till today. Well, I didn't really care that much about it, but I don't know where that's from. The third thing was that the network didn't really work because there, this is an unknown PHY that CNMAC is attaching to, which CNMAC being one of the network devices on that model. And also what sucked the most is that I didn't have a symbol table. So whenever I got a crash, I got magic hex on my screen, which looked a lot like my AV work. So I thought, okay, I'll just see. Maybe it's just a magic address that I need to add in order to support the CF flash, the compact flash. But it turns out not to be. That's not done yet. And also, the symbol table isn't fixed because that requires the installer to be able to do some magic when it, the second stage installer that Jasperat was working out, working on. It's supposed to do some magic things that put the proper pointers to the symbol table, and that's not done yet. So I thought that after this major success in 2 weeks, I was very optimistic. I said, okay, I'll be adding new drivers for the compact flash, USB support, the networking, other projects, like almost always were ahead of us, so I could glimpse there for support. But it turned out not to be such a pink situation because making the port stand on its own required mainly storage after networking, which storage comes in two flavors, the compact flash and the USB through the USB port with an external hard drive or a USB stick. And supporting the USB is really hard because it requires a new host code driver, which would be easy with the SDK that's provided by Cavium if it weren't for this section of the license, which basically says that we are subject to the US Export Administration Act, which we can't put in our project because we don't like such licenses. I don't really care to discuss this. It's just that I can't use the SDK because of that. And I think it's really stupid that the SDK has that clause in all the files, since I think it was put there just for the crypto accelerator which the SDK provides. I don't think it makes sense to have that for the real-time clock, for example, because it does no crypto whatsoever. I don't know how the law actually works, but that's my intuition. Anyway, I can't use the SDK, so a new from the bottom up host code USB driver must be written. So I'll get into that later on. The thing is that the SDK, the only use I have for it is to look at magic values of the register addresses or stuff like that. I can't use any of its logic. And also, there's no documentation for this port. So you only have the SDK and the hardware box. So it turns out to be a lot like ACPI, which is not something I enjoyed. Yeah. So I decided to start with a really simple driver, which turned out to be a really complicated driver, not because what it does, it's complicated, but because I'm not a really smart individual. I worked on this for a day and I thought it was ready. It's a random number generator, and what it does is it feeds you random numbers, or it claims to. And you just have to read from an address and see and take that as a random number. So that's why I chose this to be my first attempt at writing a driver, because it's easy to initialize. You just have to bus space map the register's address and then just keep on reading every k seconds or milliseconds or whatever. And the integration with the rest of the random subsystem is trivial. You just call a function with the given number. So the thing that you need to do during initialization on this for this driver is to read the control register, which also controls, by the way, the crypto accelerator if it's found on the model, and just ask him nicely to output, to start outputting random numbers. And shockingly, the entropy flag is separate, so you could get random numbers without entropy, I guess. I haven't tested that. And then just write things back to the controller and wait a bit for it to settle down, and you should have randomness. Easy. As I was saying, the random numbers are read then from this magical register, for the address for which I gotten from the SDK. And we read 8 bytes from it of random data and feed it to this addTrueRandomness function from our subsystem. And then wait for another 10 milliseconds and read again and feed and repeat. Now, remember when I said this was supposed to be easy and it was really complicated? It was because registers are saved in little endian in the includes in the SDK. So, but you actually have to call the address in big endian, or the other way around, I don't remember. So I spent on this like a month with a lot of printfs, because you could actually write from that read from that bogus address. You just didn't get anything, and at one point, my system at least froze. I got it to panic, but the traces were unreadable. And so I figured it out at one point. I said, like, what if this is an Indian thing? I don't remember where I saw it, on some mailing list, about the registers being in different order depending on the model or something. I said, let's just flip some bits that shouldn't take a lot of time, and it worked. So that's how I got to commit the driver.
Is that a design feature or just a
I don't know. It's all magic. I have no idea why that is. I'm guessing they have some models which they use a certain Indianness on and others that use a different one. The machines we support all use the same Indianness. Yeah. So I don't know which are these. Because all the include files are written in the wrong Indianness. So, yeah. And then they have an if, def, and an else. And I would always look at the else because, or the other way around. I don't remember. Anyway, I was confused. Yeah. Anyway, so it was working only on some machines. I started getting, and of course, when I committed the driver, I committed the wrong file, which had the Indianness wrong, and people started sending reports that it doesn't work. And I was like, wow, what? Why? And then I looked and, okay, I committed with the wrong Indianness, of course. And another report that was interesting, and I had to commit another fix for this class of registers, is the RSL registers require an immediate read after write, which is common, but some machines had a problem with that. So I'm guessing that that fixed a few other issues that Jasper Rat was seeing on his machines with the readback, because that's not the only place where it's used. So just writing this simple driver fixed a lot more than I expected. And also, I learned to be a lot more skeptical when parsing the SDK. Another thing that I'm still having troubles understanding, because the random subsystem is very complicated for my brain, is that I was told to throw away the first four bytes from the eight that I get, because the random subsystem wouldn't use them anyway. I don't know why. But if you're going to go and read the driver afterwards, that's why I was told to. And I listened to what I'm being told to. The next driver was the real-time clock, because every time I started NFS booting without proper disk support, that's the only option. And every time I was booting, I got this annoying message. So I decided that it had to stop, because obviously it's written in capital letters and the other ones weren't. So I started looking at what a real-time clock is on an Octeon. And apparently it's a crappy clock that has a 1 second resolution. And it's used just as a time of day clock, because what else could you use it for? And even though it's so, well, I assume it's so cheap, it's not found on all models. So some models don't have a real-time clock, which is, again, amazing. So the plan was to provide some get time and set time routines, and those pesky capital letters should go away after I register them as the system time of day clock. But then I took a look at the register I had to deal with, which was a register that belonged to the two-wire serial interface, whatever that is, and it had quite a complicated way of addressing things. Like it would of course, bit fields in a struct. That's from the SDK, by the way. It would set an address, and then if this second call was using the same address, it wouldn't. Now let me restart. So you have a register through which you access a multitude of registers. So through this register, this register has a field that's extended internal address and internal address. It's good that I'm pointing at my screen. Right. So extended internal address and internal address. So through this register, you would get access to other registers, including the real-time clock registers. And the first time you'd call it with the real-time clock register, the second time you wouldn't have to. You could just use the internal address for the subclass of registers. It was a bit weird for me. Not that I'm an experienced two-wire serial hacker, but it was interesting, because I'm guessing it will be useful for other things in the future, other drivers. So I would just set the address field to this register and use, as I said, the internal address across the future calls. And then I could read from this register the date in a BCD encoded format that I'm going to go into later, or I could write to it in order to set the time. And this whole, the data is packed in this data field, the last one, which is 32 bits. So after looking at this struct for a bit, it seemed rather straightforward, which it was. This was actually easy. So the reads was setting the RTC register address, setting the read bit, because I want to do a read through that TWS register. Make it valid. This valid bit plays a role of telling you when an operation is done. Then I could, after I would set this bit, I could just write the TWS register and expect data from it during the second step, when I would read it back with the data field, filled. Hmm. And this wasn't as easy as in it. I I would have to go through multiple reads because it wasn't instant. And the trick was to use this valid bit and see when it's cleared, then the data that's written in the data field is accurate. So when it was cleared, the operation was complete. The clock data was actually only the first byte of that big data field. The writes were done in a similar fashion, with setting the RTC register address, clearing the bit, setting the valid bit, and then filling the data field with the date we want to set, in order to make sure that the write was properly done. We would just keep reading back until the valid bit is cleared. And in some cases, that wasn't enough for the write. An extra readback after the valid bit was cleared was required for the actual date to come back. So awesomeness achieved. The RTC format is very intuitive. It's BCD coded. This is actually code from the driver. The only retarded thing that I think we do, or I don't know, maybe it's common BSD custom to do that, is that if we're in the 2000s, we add 100 to the year. So this would be the year of 114. Which was kind of hard to get to. I didn't actually understand why the year wasn't in the proper format. It is common, right? Right. I wasn't familiar with that. But otherwise, each bit sequence would imply a date field, like the month, the day, the day of week. And the logical ends are just making sure that they're in the right interval, like 30 days or 7 days in a week or stuff like that, seconds. So that's just how the machine feeds the data to us, and that's how we have to write it back to it. The set time and get time routines turned out to be a packing and unpacking of this in this format, and then reading and writing a packet through the TWS registers, like I described before. The issues I had with this driver was the very fragile state of this interface, with the integrity checks that I described, and I was kind of surprised to see that some models don't have the RTC clock and thus were panicking when we were trying to attach. That one being the edge router light. I don't know if others have or don't have the RTC clock. I asked on a public mailing list on Tech for reports. I asked again when we made a release with this driver, because currently we maintain a blacklist, but I would have liked to turn it into a whitelist for the release. But seeing that I got no feedback, I just left it with a blacklist. Moving on, I was quite confident to look at the network, which wasn't working, hence the network. It was really strange why it wasn't working once I got to userland, because I was actually doing all my booting, and the userland was fetched from NFS, so kind of weird. But once I logged in, the CNMAC interface showed that there's no carrier, and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't reach the network. Everything worked, though, on NFS. So I started looking into it. There were like a lot of helpful people that told me, oh, just add this magic string to the BG PHY, and you should probably have a supported PHY that will fix this. That wasn't the case, because the missing Broadcom PHY driver was from the Five Free family. And of course, other projects had drivers for it. I looked at the OpenWRT for the registers values. It's a BSD licensed driver, which is nicely written by the guys there, and it's BSD licensed as well. So I gave the guy proper credits by adding his license as well to my driver. But it's my driver is written differently. It's a bit more simplified, and it only does the minimal required stuff for that phi on the Octeon. Because for the rest, so like this phi has switch support, which of course we don't have, only in dump mode. And the OpenWRT driver had some switch support for the Linux framework. In the meantime, I'm looking at other solutions that I'm going to discuss later on. But the bottom line was that I need a separate PHY driver for my network to work. So the main problem, I think, was just reading the link state in the duplex mode, and then setting it up properly. So that turned out to be rather easy once I knew the register addresses. The nice thing is that it's the same for, I mean, adding support for a switch now after reading how the registers are organized is supposed to be really easy once we have a framework, and that's a future project. In order to set that, the reads were done by going to the proper page number, to the proper page, and setting the register address for what register we wanted, like the duplex or the port speed or whatever, and then reading back the features it had. Once we had that, we read the first two bytes from the data register of the PHY. And we could go on for other data registers, but that's something that will be used when switch support is in place. So with that simple read, with those simple reads, I was able to have link, have a proper media, and reach the internet. So now network is working on that. I think this fixes, I haven't heard back, but I think this fixes the issue on other models as well. This is, I only added the PHY identification numbers for my model, but I asked for reports from the edge router lights and the other models we support. So this should, I actually finished this week before getting here, so. This should probably grow in the following weeks, the list of supported PHYs. So for future plans, I closely worked with Ray from the Zrouter project ever since I started working on the Octeon. And he has a kernel switch framework, which I looked at. I think FreeBSD has it by now in their tree. I'm not really sure. I think they do. And there's also a solution from Kazuya Goda. I think I'm saying his name properly. I hope so. If not, I'm sorry. From IIJ, which is supposed to import his solution to the NetBSD tree in the following days, if he hasn't already. And one of these two will probably reach the OpenBSD tree as well. Just waiting for the IIJ framework to be public in order to be able to compare. And then we should, yeah? Nice. I'm in contact with them. I read some emails from them 2 days ago. They were on vacation, so they couldn't respond by the time I was writing this presentation. So anyway, the idea is that we should have something soon, I hope, if politics or anything else doesn't get in the way. Now, I'm going to talk about future projects and drivers that are really getting annoyingly needed by the entire OpenBSD community because it's about disk support. So the first thing is the USB host controller, which there's existing public work on it. The KVM SDK, which would be awesome to have, but we can't because of the license. Linux uses it. I think FreeBSD uses it as well. There's also an IIJ driver for the CN30 boards, which I have access to. I don't know if it's public or not, but the diff I have has the proper license. But the problem is that this driver doesn't work on the DSR, which is a 5.0 board, and I think the only one that it works on are their IIJ networking appliance. I wasn't able to make it work, and it's quite different than what the SDK is doing. Also, I started writing a driver, which so far I managed to make it fry USB sticks that I plug in. It's really nice. I lost 5 by now. It's testing is welcomed. So what I've done so far is that I have the clock routine set up and the host mode set up. The device mode is far from even being started. I have DMA. Well, of course, how would you fry the USB stick otherwise? And I have part of the interrupt routine almost done. The thing is that this kind of work requires a lot of focus and a lot of continuous time to be spent on it, at least for me, because I forget everything after 2 days. And I need to be able to go to the almost reverse engineered logic from the two solutions, from the IIJ and the SDK one, and the registers, which are very, very useful. And so it's going really slow because of that. I'm trying to go back to it every time, but it's really frustrating and it doesn't give me any satisfaction besides losing money on USB sticks. So the interrupt routine is almost done, as I was saying. Of course, there are some issues. It assumes a single USB port. Yeah, sure, if you have like crappy ones. Yep. I actually set up my multimeter to try and see the current state on my USB port, but that didn't work out. I'm not really smart. The device disconnect interrupts are also in place. The only problem is that it doesn't call back, so the user won't know if it's disconnected. But you'll know, by the way, it's blinking like crazy, and you'll plug it into your Windows box, and it will be, do you want to format this drive? And then there's no drive there out of the blue, so you can't even format it. I don't know. It's something electrical. So the major showstoppers are that I can't use the SDK, which would have been neat. The logic, the way the IIJ and the SDK do the interrupt routines are completely different. So I don't know how, like even the registers they use are different, but the order also. I tried to reuse the IIJ code, as I was saying, but it doesn't work, my D-Link. And USB is really hard, like the USB specification, because I just started reading them a year ago or so, and I just managed to fall asleep. And then the USB without the proper documentation for the controller is even harder. And as I was saying, the worst part and the most depressing part is that it requires time, which I'm not able at the moment to put into it, like full time for, I don't know, a few months or something. So, but the main issue is documentation and the SDK license, actually, because I'm betting if documentation was in place, a lot of smarter people would chip in and write the proper driver. I only have patience and fetish for frustration on my side. That's why I'm doing this. otherwise other people would, which are more suited for this task. We have USB people. I'm not a USB person.
That's what they all say.
Right.
Yeah, every person who's a USB person in OpenBSD rapidly tries to find another part of the operating.
That's just coincidence. You have no evidence.
Anything worse is ACPI. Hey, Mike, you want to work on USB?
So, the next bit was adding support for the flash memory that's found on the DSR 500, which turned out to be a lot more complicated, as in a new driver is needed. And of course, no docs for it. FreeBSD supports it through CFI, which this is a bit from their D message on it. And you can see the huge amount of 32 megabytes. And the CFI, I think, FreeBSD are the only ones that have support for this interface. I'm at the second attempt to port the FreeBSD driver. Actually, the second one isn't a porting effort, it's a from scratch effort, because it's completely different from what we do with disk drives. I've discussed the issue with David Guaney, DLG at, which is a disk guru, as far as I'm concerned, anyway. And he suggested that he wanted to do this, but he doesn't have the time to. So he suggested he's guiding me into writing a proper driver for this by writing a small ATA driver, which seems and is an overkill, in my opinion. So that we can plug it into the ATA's SCSI subsystem. The thing is that the ATA's SCSI subsystem is really complex. It's not thought of for simple compact flash devices. So this one, for example, wouldn't have multiple concurrence commands like IO commands and control commands. And it doesn't do port multipliers, so most of the ATA SCSI infrastructure is useless for this. We don't use it. That's why I think it's too complicated. So I started really enthusiastically, but it's being my first driver and looking at ATA SCSI. Progress kind of slowed down. The reference drivers are really complicated again, as I was saying. AHCI, for example, it has a lot of its code looking at concurrent commands and port multipliers. And I just want to read and write to some registers, because that's how you get data from the compact flash. It's no DMA. You just do bus-based reads and writes. And the way the other driver on the Octeon is doing it is through WDC, the PCI IDE driver, which is very messy because it's a layer violation all the way, and I'm not able to follow it, at least not with a sane mind. And that's why I wanted something clean. So just started working on it, and I'm kind of writing 100 lines, deleting 150, going back at it. And I'm thinking of, in the end, of making use of the FreeBSD abstraction, which is the CFID from disk, and then CFI attaching to ATA SCSI, because I think that's more sane to separate the operations like that. I started initially as FreeBSD would have a CFID attached to ATA SCSI. So I'm thinking now that I should separate the entire interface from the actual disk driver. Also, I'm contemplating about keeping the driver machine dependent or making it machine independent. Machine dependent is easy because peer review is easier, and I hate peer review. Machine independent is nice because some other people might chip in and help, but I would get sworn at a lot before that, so I'm not sure which is the way to go. I think first it will be MD and then moved upstream. I don't know. I don't know if I should start supporting the entire CFI specification or just the bits required for this compact flash. Looking at the FreeBSD driver, it has a lot of if-def mazes for the Intel platform, which apparently does things differently, of course. And also if-def for Strata Flash, which is another Intel invention. So I'm not sure. I think I should just start simple and then add the rest. I tried that, but going deeper and deeper down the Flash interface, it looks like I might have to extend to full specs. I don't know. This is work in progress, as I was saying. So in the end, OpenBSD Octeon is mostly harmless. It doesn't do anything. It's not useful. It's far from being a standalone port because of disk support, but otherwise, if you like NFS, who does, you should be able to use it. The issues are the lack of documentation, which is slowing progress, even though a lot of work was put into it. A lot of people have spent time on creating this platform, and I thank them for that. And the IIJ people gave the initial support for it, which is, again, very nice. But unfortunately, other common developers like me are not able to go full speed because of documentation and the SDK copyright. So the remaining open problems, as far as I'm concerned, are the USB controller support, the switch framework, but I wouldn't know if that's the second one or the compact flash interface. Like the CFI on for my model at least would only bring in 32 megabits, so you'd be able to boot the kernel, and I don't know, you would need to have a stripped down operating system anyway, which is what the Zrouter project is doing, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to create a separate mini project that strips down OpenBSD just for this model. I want the entire operating system there. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm continuously working on making this port complete. I'm very sorry about the pace at which this is going, but I'm hoping it will gather more users that will help other developers gather around it once USB support is in. And I think that's it. Questions? Yeah, I don't know why. Well, actually, before the driver, it wasn't doing anything, so I must be doing something, right? But I'm just poking registers, and I'm hoping it's in the right way. It's like it was when ACPI started. At one point, it will settle down, and we won't lose hardware because of it, but in the beginning. I have no idea why. I mean, I'm...
Just don't forget, a lot of these hardware bits these days, they bake the hardware and then realize afterwards, oh, that was kind of fun.
Actually, a few...
So they issue errata in software, and in this case, the errata will be in the SDK buried away somewhere to say...
It could be.
Oh, don't actually do this, or it will actually spit stuff out of the USB port that's out of spec.
Yeah.
So, but if you don't know that, oops.
I can see small sparks. It's nice. You can, in my office, it's really nice. It's like fireworks. Yeah. Yep?
Is there any way to get the supplier of the SDK to update their license and remove those?
Good question. I don't know how would I go about that. I mean, I would just send a mail to KVM and ask them to remove that. The thing is that if they developed the software on US soil, they can't remove that. I don't know why they put it on the rest of the files besides the crypto ones. I could ask that, but I'm not sure how it goes with licenses. I'm not knowledgeable as far as licenses go, but I'm not sure you can go back.
Say that's a great idea, go ask your lawyer, and the lawyer will say, no.
Can you actually go back like that?
From sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so that would be interesting to ask something like that. But then I would probably have to issue a list of files that have that license and another list that don't. I don't know if they're, yeah, I could try that.
Yeah,
Thanks. Yep.
What was that 100 that was added to the year?
So if it's 1995, you'd have the year as 95. If so, when you go to 2000, you would have the year as 00, right? But you don't know if it's 1900 or if it's 2000. So you add 100 to it to know that it's 2000.
It's basically years since 1900, which is very common.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you. I'm not touching that. I think so. 12:30, right?
This licensing stuff ever with Theo?
Yeah, he just said
can't use it.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that is.
So I understand why, but it's in our policy.
Then the right thing to go about is probably to talk to the people who develop the code. First, find out who is actually the right to re-release it under a different license, and if you are the right person. Even if you only get part of the code under a different license, chances